Hello and welcome to the Open Talent Report. This is the podcast where we discuss the emerging trends in labor law, employment law, independent work, and the gig economy, which many organizations are wrestling with due to the growth of the open talent and gig economy. I'm your host, Conor Heaney. When I'm not presenting the podcast, I'm the MD at CXC Global, EMEA, which compliantly connects talent and opportunity. Hello and welcome to this week's podcast, where I'm delighted to welcome Jason Levin, who is an author, speaker, coach, and executive. Jason is the author of an amazing book called Relationships to Infinity, The Art and Science of Keeping in Touch. And I have to say, I'm absolutely delighted to have Jason on the show. He's a very patient man because we've been trying to make this show happen for some time. Jason, we're incredibly grateful that you're here and a warm welcome to you. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing well, Connor. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, we're delighted, Jason, and I think you're our first author on the show, right? So it's an exciting moment for us, for sure. And before we get into the book, and I'm keen to cover this in some detail for our audience, would you mind just giving our audience this sort of pop quiz version of Jason Levin to date, your career history, if that's okay, Jason?
Sure. So for me, the career history started when I was in high school. I was growing up in northern New Jersey, a suburb of New York City, and my father lost his job during the recession in America in 1989-1990. And so I became the wackiest high school kid you ever met. I wanted to know why people got jobs and why people lost jobs. And so at the ripe young age of 15, I was reading the Wall Street Journal, Forbes, and Fortune. And if we were friends in university and college, I was helping you mock interview and look for internships. So you could say for the last 30 years, that has been an underlying theme in my career. I've worked in management consulting at Anderson Consulting before it became Accenture. I lived in France for 5 years. I was a Rotary Scholar winner. I studied in Lyon, and then I moved to Paris to work with KPMG in Paris, and then for an MBA event organizer working with grad schools. I went to get my MBA at Georgetown. Wow. And then I went to work for Unilever in brand management on Dove lotions and creams. And from there, I took a sales management role where I was working for a career website, Vault.com. But underlying that all has been an interest in helping people progress and why people are succeeding. And so 11 years ago, I went out on my own, founded Ready, Set, Launch. With the idea that we could bring the same principles to Dove lotions and creams to people, taking consumer brand principles and making people's personal brand or personal brand accessible. So for the past 11 years, I've been a speaker, trainer, and coach, and it's been a great ride.
Well, tell you, Jason, that is a bloody fascinating career history. I'm interested, you speak about the Great Recession back in 1989 and how that impacted your dad and your family, I guess, and of course you, Jason. And something similar happened to me, actually, in our family. So my dad was a construction, his own business guy. He set up his own business at 16 and I suppose lost everything in terms of success, business, home, back in the Great Recession of 2008 to 2010 in Europe. And I have to say, that really impacted me, actually. I've always been interested in business. I've been lucky to work in business. I've been lucky to go with the ebbs and flow of business. But it's interesting the impact that can have on your business outlook. For me personally, I really believe in the hero to zero principle. And what I mean by that, Jason, is I never want to be zero, but I'm acutely aware that one can be zero through happenstance, right? Through no fault of your own. You're just sitting there one day and you're at the top of the tree and the next you're bloody at the bottom of it trying to scramble back up. And I suppose I'd be interested in your take how people can rebuild themselves. And I hadn't thought to ask this, Jason. It was just that you'd mentioned that at the beginning. But what are the typical tools that one can do if they've been impacted by the Great Recession? Because if you read the economic commentary, there appears to be one in the USA currently, and one coming potentially globally. How bad it is, we don't know.
Right. You know, and this is something that I saw in observing when my father lost his job. It was essentially the only company I'd worked for over 20 years. And it was almost like losing a family member. So there was a funeral process that he needed to go through because, as we all know, work is not just work. It's the engagement and interaction with others. And so not having that routine, not having that place to go, there's an emotional piece to losing a job that we all need to acknowledge. And once you acknowledge that, then you can process, all right, what's my next step and how do I think about that? And so often people want to help you, but once you get beyond the, all right, I've lost my job, I've come to grips with it, I'm ready to get to my next step. The second piece is, and people struggle with this, well, what do you want to do? And people often, what do you want to do? That is the, you know, and it's one of those things where people miss an opportunity to help others help them. And you have to nail the what do you want to do question. And it's not what do you want to do for the rest of years, but where do you see yourself in 12 to 18 months? And how can you identify people that can help you get to that next step? So I think that people need to, one, process that layoff, and then, you know, you don't spend your entire week just job seeking. That's misery. You need to, you know, often when I'm working with people that are in transition, I'm like, all right, what brings you energy? Is it yoga? Is it music? Is it exercise? I want them to get out and volunteer a little and see, you know, that there are other people that are worse off. And actually, people derive a lot of energy from helping others. So in that transition, there's a whole set of portfolio activities that people can be doing to gain energy and then identify industries, sectors, roles that they want to be working in and head in that direction.
Yeah, Jason, I love that advice and that thought process. Another thought, and I hope you don't mind me asking this question, but I'm thinking about the difference between perceived success and perceived failure. And do you think it comes down that the people that are able to cope with being successful one day and being a perceived failure the next, do you think it's something to do with their acceptance that life is not a linear process, right? And if you can be pragmatic, flexible, agile, realize that it's not always going to go the way that you want it, that you're better able to cope with whatever comes your way, good, negative?
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things where, you know, whatever moment in your life, with a high school, college, first job, you know, fifth job, whatever that is, where you mess up. Either you mess up or something happens that's beyond your control. And more often than not, when, you know, when we talk about a recession or the Great Recession, because, you know, there have been recessions, you know, decade in and decade out.
Yes.
There are things that are beyond your own control. Right. And once you accept that there are things beyond your control, but there are things that you can control, then it becomes a function of how do you respond? And responding to uncertainty, respond and making that response an intention of your own, that gets back to mindset. That gets back to how you think about yourself and how you treat yourself on a daily basis. Are you kind to yourself? Are you soothing to yourself? Are you forgiving of yourself? And once you can have that better conversation with yourself, then you can respond to others and then respond to your environment and respond what's happening. But I agree with you that, you know, in challenging times, you get the true test of what that conversation is going on with yourself, how to recognize when there are thoughts or things or negative things that are holding you back, and how you can unlock that, right? You know, for me, one of my favorite things to do that just gets complete clarity, I go swimming and I blow bubbles. And, you know, with two boys, 9 and 11, where there's just noise in the house, I find joy in swimming because I have quiet and it helps me think and recenter. And so often the things that you're talking about, you need to be able to identify what are the things that calm you down, what are the things that center you, so that you can make an honest and logical next step in what you want to do.
Yeah, I like that. I tell you, Jason, that's great. That's great advice. The other thing, just on this topic, I do want to come back to your book, Jason. I haven't forgotten about it, because I think there's some really fascinating concepts that you explore, and I think our audience would be well served to listen to them and understand them. But thinking about that recession in '89, and then the recession in the late '90s when .com went bust, and then after unfortunately 9/11 in the United States. At that time, there was no safety net in terms of opportunities were limited. There was no gig economy. There was no platform economy. If I think about the emergence of the platformization of work and the growth of the gig economy post 2010, it was a real catalyst for change. And if I think about recessions that are coming, in a way, the gig economy has provided, or potentially can provide, a safety net of sorts. So if you do lose your job, then you still got the potential to potentially walk into a gig or a number of gigs and still maintain at least some earnings. What's your thought about the gig economy, bizarrely, as a safety net? I don't know if too many people think about it from that perspective, but what's your take, Jason?
You know, and I think you're raising a really interesting point. You know, whether you call it gig economy or contingency work or consulting or whatever that is, for me, it does wonderful things after a layoff. And I agree that in the late 80s, you know, even after the .com, there were not those, one, the structures available, and then two, the perception of what gig work can do. For me, whenever people are in transition, gig work does a couple of things. One, it gets you income coming in the door, which is wonderful. But then second, it's a validation of your experience. It keeps your confidence up. It helps you think about, you know, solving problems that you know how to solve. And then people are asking, well, how are your job search going and what's going on? And you're like, actually, here's what I'm consulting on, or here's the portfolio of consulting projects that I'm doing. I'm a huge fan of gig work. And now that, you know, that's one of the benefits of technology, is that there are platform sites, you know, you can be using your social tools to say that you're available for gig work. There's even a higher acceptance of bringing on contractors and gig work because you don't have to pay those benefits. So I think that, you know, in 2022, you know, the gig economy, even, you know, even people that are working full time now, they have their side hustle.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I you know, it's funny because, you know, both my wife and myself were actually in side hustles. And it became our main hustle. Like, I was coaching on the side and training on the side for years before I went out on my own, you know, 11 years ago. You know, my wife, 7 years ago, she had made something on the side, which was wonderful, helping parents return back to work after leave. And now it's her main hustle. So, you know, I think this notion of your main job getting all of your intellectual and emotional satisfaction is no longer true. I think we're very dynamic and faceted people. And so your job and some of those things can satisfy that. But, you know, there might be other things. You know, you were talking earlier about your garden, and, you know,
yes,
that's where you can derive, you know, some of your own joy that you're not getting in your day job. So I think that I'm a huge fan of gig work. I think it does so many positive things. And when I'm working with my clients, I'm like, all right, let's think about these temporary things that can either bring in money or satisfy you intellectually, so that you have a reason to get out of bed in the morning, right? It's wonderful.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's that last point, I think potentially is the most meaningful one. That reason to get out of bed, that meaningful and being made to feel like you're contributing and that you've got value and that you're recognized and that you're clocking in and clocking out. It might not be the same job that you did last week or last year or 10 years ago, but you're contributing and you're feeling that you're contributing. And I think that's such an important thing. So really appreciate you sharing your views there, Jason. Thank you so much. And Jason, if we may, I'd love to come on to your book, and I suppose the first question in relation to that is, what made you decide to write a book in the first place? What was the burning platform or the need or the driving force to sit down and have that dedication and application to share that knowledge?
So So the funny thing is that when I started my business 11 years ago, I told my wife, I'm going to write a book and it's going to be called Relationships to Infinity. So it has taken me 11, it's taken me 11 years to get to this point. And I feel a great deal of joy that I was going to even do that. In the interim, of course, my wife, who's the writer's writer, she wrote her book, Back to Work After Baby. And she's, you know, she's much better than writer than I am. But, you know, for me, the desire to put a book out there was that I think that, you know, we all have a voice and I wanted to share my voice in that format. I think the reason I finally wrote the book now was that, you know, during the pandemic and we went virtual, we all became wilted flowers. And we saw, even the introverts saw, wow, I still need to interact with people. And so I said to myself, you know what, Relationships to Infinity needs to come to life. And so I actually, it was, you know, I feel very blessed in the United States. I also do radio segments. There was a Bloomberg journalist that had done some career segments with me. And she said, listen, I took this class through Georgetown University. It's a book writing class. I think you have a book in you. I think you should take this class. And so for a year, I went through the class and, you know, as I said before, I've got kids that are 9 and 11. The only time I could find time to write was Saturday mornings at 7 o'clock in the morning when everybody was sleeping. And I cared that deeply about, and this topic I cared deeply about, because I think we use words, Connor, we use the word have a network. We use the word networking, and we don't fully comprehend where they come from, where the history comes from, why those things are important. And that's what I wanted to bring to the universe, is to say, all right, when you say have a network, this is what that means. And these are the tactical and practical things that you can do based on the social science we already know. And for me, that was the driving force that, yes, we need connection. Yes, we need people. But I wanted to shine a light on some really foundational topics within what's known in the academic community as network theory. That's why I wanted to write the book. I was like, it's time. It's time. And also, one final thing on this.
Yes.
In my work, I get to challenge my clients, whether it's through training or speaking or coaching. And I looked at myself in the mirror and I said, you know what? I need to challenge myself. I need to get out of my own comfort zone. And writing this book also was taking me to a place that got me uncomfortable. And so it's nice to even have my own iteration of myself and what I want to do. So there you go.
I tell you what, Jason, I feel like writing a book after that. It was so passionate and eloquent what you just said. I really, seriously, I can tell why you're very successful at what you do. And if you wouldn't mind, Jason, thanks for that explanation, would you mind just focusing on some of the key concepts that the book addresses and some of the practical steps or advice that you've got in the book about really keeping in touch in a more meaningful and I suppose better way?
Yeah, and thank you. I mean, I love this topic because I can see what it does for people, not only in their individual and personal lives, but in their professional lives. So I think for me, a couple of the foundational pieces of the book, one is what is network theory and what can we learn from it? I think the two foundational pieces within network theory are the concepts of the strength of weak ties and the power of dormant ties. So what is that? In 1973, Mark Renovetter was a researcher in the Boston area, and he came up with the concept of the strength of weak ties, where he uncovered that people found their jobs not through people they knew closely, but through acquaintances. And so he came up with the concept of the strength of weak ties in 1973. It did not become famous until Malcolm Gladwell wrote his book, The Tipping Point, in 2000. So I was living in Paris at the time in 2000, and I think I read Tipping Point in 2001. And The Tipping Point for me was a really seminal book in how I thought about life after that. Because the way Gladwell talks about strength of weak ties is this notion of a connector. People that connect one person with the next and say, you know what, you two should meet because you have similarity in common. So this notion of strength of weak ties is really, really important. And then you fast forward to 2011, where a group of researchers came up with the concept of the power of dormant ties, where they asked a group of executives, okay, take a current business problem you have and then share it with people you currently know. And then take that same business problem and share it with people that you've lost touch with. And the way they defined losing touch was over 3 years. What came back, the contrast was stark. The people they lost touch with was giving, they were giving better advice. They were giving better insights. And so the researchers went on to conclude the people you lose touch with actually go on to have new experiences. They go on to build new networks and gain new insights. And so here, these two concepts, strength of weak ties, power of dormant ties, create opportunities for all of us where, you know, during the pandemic, some people closed their circles to a tighter circle. Some people wanted to hear from others. What if we, in an intentional way, began to think about our weak ties and dormant ties as part of our monthly activities? And so then I began to look at, you know, how we can bring these things to life and how can we take these notions and what's holding us back from getting back in touch. And so I developed the concept of the Bermuda Keep in Touch Triangle.
And, love it.
And so, because I, you know, over 10 years, I'm working with my clients, you know, in trainings, and I'm like, they're lost. They're lost in their own head. Just like, you know, planes and ships get lost in the Bermuda Triangle, so do our own intentions to get back in touch with others. And so I reached out to the mental health community and I was talking to, you know, sociologists and psychiatrists. And I was like, what's going on here? What are these barriers to keeping in touch? What are these barriers to connection that we want and we so much need? Because intellectually, if you fully subscribe to dormant ties and you subscribe to weak ties, we should be able to get back in touch. And so then the triangle has three pillars: guilt, fear, and worry. These are normal human emotions that we feel when we want to get back in touch with somebody. The guilt is, it's my fault. The relationship is not where it should be, when in reality, the relationship just fizzled. The fear of being rejected, the fear of not looking smart, the fear of all these things. And then it turns into worry, where your amygdala triggers and you're running away from a bear. And so, you know, to recognize it and to give it a name, this is what's going on in my head right now. And so when we talk about intentional connection and getting back in touch, there's even social science on how to break that. And psychologists almost always talk about, well, talk about the most likely scenario. What will most likely happen? And here's the thing, to get to the most likely scenario, you need to create crazier scenario. What's the worst thing that's going to happen if you try to get back in touch with somebody? And you create this crazy scenario that you write an email to somebody, hey, I want to get back in touch. And they respond, you terrible person, I don't want to ever hear from you again. I can't believe that you even tried to get back in touch with me. And that's an unlikely scenario, right? And then you create the most positive scenario. And the most positive scenario is, oh my God, you got back in touch with me. Here's $10 million. Here's my boat. I'm going to write you into my will. Thank you so much. When can we move in together? And that's also an unlikely scenario. And so to get to that most likely scenario, you write to somebody and they either write back and say, great, let's catch up, or they don't respond, you know? And when you are able to do that, plus journal, you know, you move from the amygdala to writing it down, you know, what's going to actually happen if I write to this person? Then you're actually getting to a place that's more logical. I think the final piece in the book that is an aha moment for a lot of people is that there's a ton of social science around being able to leverage nostalgia. So, and I call it intentional nostalgia, professional nostalgia, personal nostalgia. Sharing a memory Sharing a positive memory, sharing gratitude with someone is the best way to get back in touch with somebody. So Connor, I remember when we were back in university and da-da-da-da-da, and you remember when we were at that football match and this happened, and I thought of you. Let's catch up. Is a better way to connect and reconnect with someone. So you can do this with your friends, you can do this with your family, you can do this with past colleagues, all along that continuum if you're thinking about your dormant and your weak ties. So what network theory does for us is the answer to the question, Connor, where do I begin? Where do I begin with all the people that I know and all the things going on in my life? It is the analog piece to the question, where do I begin? And then we can leverage nostalgia to what do I say? What do I share? What do I feel? And that gets to authentic connection, not the transaction, not the grin and grab, the authentic connection as human beings we all seek.
Well,
that's the joy.
That's very powerful, Jason, I have to say. And I think what underlines all what you've just said is actually there's a lot to be said for the Nike logo or phrase, just do it, right? Mm-hmm. And that advice around either catastrophizing the worst that can happen or, I suppose, articulating the best that can happen, either of those outcomes, it'll probably fall somewhere in between, right? And if you just start it and just bloody do it, then you've got a good chance of making it successful. Would you agree?
I completely agree. And when I do my seminars on this topic, it has been, I find so much joy. People are saying, you know, I got back in touch with that first manager of mine from my first job out of you know, college or uni, and it's been 30 years. I reached out to that friend. I reached out to that family member. And it snowballs. They realize, wow, this is not that hard. And this is something that I can do as part of my life. You know, we come up with these things, you know, back to mindset, we come up with these things. I don't have the time. I'm like, you can take 15 minutes, identify someone that you want to share gratitude with or share a memory with. And that's something you can do on a daily basis. This is not something that is beyond the reach of possibility. Because my daily intention, after my kids go to school and I've got myself in my zone for the work that I need to do, is, okay, who can I thank today? I have so many wonderful things going on in my life. Who can I thank today, either currently or some, or I know all these different types of things. Who taught me this to allow me to do what I can do? And leveraging that notion of nostalgia, and nostalgia connects all of us. It connects us in a way that allows us to be remembered that we had an impact on somebody. So yes, just do it is a wonder. Just do it is a great way of thinking about it.
Yeah, I like to keep things in the simplest terms. It really helps me, Jason. But like, you know, Jason, I have to say, like, some of the concepts there that you've outlined, I as I mentioned, I really love them. A lot of our audience are in HR, talent acquisition, they're in solution sales or on the sell or buy side of HR and procurement. And some of them, I would imagine, are what I would describe, or as Gladwell might describe, as super connectors. But let's say you're not a super connector, but you want to become one. Is there any practical steps and advice you would give Jason to become a super connector, the connector of connectors?
You know, I think, you know, getting back to connection is listening to somebody and asking them how they're doing and what's on their mind and what's interesting to them. And then when you start to aggregate these conversations, you're like, wait a minute, I had this great conversation with so-and-so, and this is what they're working on. And I know another person that I think they should get together. And it's either you're in the same industry or you're in the same sector. You know, on the sales side, helping people out is a wonderful use of time. I mean, the cliche, how do you add value, you know, just like makes my eyes roll over. It's one of those things where adding value is like the most cliched advice. It's like, yes, how do you add value? You add value by listening to the person and then saying, you know what? I thought about what you said. I actually listened to what you said, and I have an idea for you. And that could be easily as taking somebody that you know needs help or would benefit from someone else you trust and making that connection. And that's on the sales side. On the HR side, you know, when we think about networks, there's an internal network within your own organization. And strength of weak ties and dormant ties also works within organizations. And this is another training that I do around mentorship and sponsorship. And it goes to the same notions that how can you either formally or informally engage your employees with others that could benefit from people that have either technical knowledge or soft skill knowledge or whatever you want to call it, being more intentional about how you can bring people together, that's connecting. That's and doing it in a way that's natural. And so that could be also in a daily intention. I'm like, all right, who can I help out today? Is there someone within my world that I can say, you know what, I just had a coffee with somebody that's in the education space. And I said, you know what, I want to introduce you to somebody else that has a great deal of experience in education. I don't know what's going to come of this, but I feel like you two should know each other, right? That's what people can do to be intentional about connecting others and taking it in a way that's actually going to solve a problem because you've actually listened in the first place.
Yeah, I like that really practical advice, that intentionality, Jason. I want to come on to, in my view, and I'm sure you'll agree, there's been a huge explosion in communication channels, right? And part of that has been fueled, of course, by the recent pandemic. So we've seen the growth of Microsoft Teams. We've seen email explode. We've seen Facebook chat, Facebook Messenger, WhatsApp, Zoom chat, Weibo, which is down in I think that's our WeChat. I can never pronounce it right, but you'll get the drift. Instagram, iMessage, and also all sorts of communication channels. And it feels to me that we're communicating on the face of it more than ever. But my suspicion, and perhaps my assumption, is that communication actually meaningful? Is it intentional? Does it matter? Is it necessary? What's your take on this? Is that a rather cynical view from my point of view, Jason, or would you agree or disagree?
So, you know, Connor, it gets me, and I was actually doing a leadership training within a hospital system, and the conversation became around, are we being efficient or are we being effective? And I think with all of the technology tools and what we've seen during the pandemic is a high level of efficiency, a high level of transaction, right? The text message, the direct message, the let's get the work done. Here's what we need to do. And here's the agenda. And let's make that happen. Getting to effective, I think, is where we can take a step back and say, all right, if we have that possibility that we can meet in person or go for a walk, or even let's have a time where we can just be, then you're getting to a place where you get to know the person. So, and I think there are types of work that makes us efficient, and those tools are like, all right, let's just bang this out. We have this agenda, we know what we need to get done. But being creative and thinking strategic, that takes more than a technology tool. That takes an interaction and a series of interactions and the time and space to do so. So I agree with you that there's all these technology platforms and how we can communicate and those kinds of things. It can be a little bit overwhelming, but I put that in the efficient bucket. We're still human beings, Connor. And I are still human beings. And so we need that connection also. And that's where I say, well, let's use the technology tools to either meet in person in some way, shape, or form. If that's not possible, then let's pick a platform and design a conversation where we're going to try and connect more rather than just get things done because of it.
Yeah, I think that's great advice. And Jason, I'd just like to expand on that a bit more, but in the context of the so-called Great Resignation, which appears to have disproportionately affected the United States of America, where you're based today, and I appreciate you're an international and global speaker and author, but if we can just look at the USA and the Great Resignation for a moment, there seems to have been, at least if you listen to the popular commentators and the received wisdom, a shift from employer power to employee power, right? The employee matters, right? She or he matters potentially more than they ever did before, right? And they need to be looked after, and they've got the power of movement, because there's a full jobs market, full economy, full labor force in the USA, and most organizations are still hiring like it's going out of bloody fashion, right? So my question really is, based on the insights and analysis from your book and your experience, Jason, what can the organization, the employer, do to communicate with and to employees better, in your view?
You know, and I think you're talking about, and you know, we can get American-centric, and I'm happy to. What has happened in the past 2 years has been quite significant. So the Great Resignation, part of it was the notion that I just don't want to do this anymore, and I'm leaving a bad manager. So that's the classic year. People don't leave employers; they leave bad managers. Yes. There's a secondary piece, and that's more the how the American system functions. You had many moms. It was in the U.S. It was known as the she session. You had moms leaving the workforce because of a lack of childcare. And I say this as a dad, that it is shameful that in America we still do not have the support systems to help our infant children, our kids in preschool, in elementary school. Moms were leaving the workforce in droves because of a lack of childcare. And so when you look at the numbers from a demographic perspective, moms, in 2022, we still have these traditional views on what men do and what women do.
Yes.
So I think the sub-story of this Great Resignation was that it was forced. You know, moms had no choice. School, for an entire year, and for some it was even more, like school was virtual and our kids were home. So the employer, so then, all right, in 2022, looking forward, what do we do?
Yes.
The employers that have figured out that kids don't raise themselves and the parents need help, they're the ones that are succeeding. And I won't name the billionaires that say, all right, get back to work. I'm like, all right, you want to talk about being out of touch? I would say that's deeply out of touch. So yes, I think a lot of, so you take it more at 30,000 feet. Yes, people that have had the luxury and say, you know what, is this something I really want to be doing? Am I making an impact? Those kinds of conversations have been happening. Absolutely. I think the employers that are going to win and retain their talent, because certainly there is a recruiting frenzy going on. I don't have to tell you this.
Yes.
It's really, are employers going to give the flexibility to the and the respect that employees deserved? Are they going to give them the autonomy to get their work done in the way that it should get done? And then, at the end of the day, there was a study done several years back that your happiness does increase for every $1,000 of salary you make up until $75,000 annual, right? The
Yes.
moment you go above $75,000 in annual salary, your happiness is derived from other types of things. And in the knowledge economy, and I feel very blessed to know plenty of people that are making more than $75,000 a year. And when that happens, then it's feeling valued, feeling heard, having the flexibility to get your work done. That's what employers and managers are needing to offer to their employees. And for the ones that are just saying, all right, it's 2022, let's go back to the office as if nothing has happened, they're losing people.
Yeah, I think that's a really excellent summary, Jason. And I agree with it. And Jason, you mentioned earlier that we're both human. Thank goodness, right? And sometimes I have to check myself, right?
Seriously,
but we are. Thank goodness for that. But I want to touch briefly, just Jason, on your views on automation and its potential impact on workers and jobs displacement. Are you concerned, if we look to the future of work, about automation's impact on humans?
So this has been going on for decades, you know, the rise of the robot. You know, and I remember Arnold Schwarzenegger in Terminator. So when I think of automation, that's where my mind goes first.
Me too.
So, but the good thing is the Terminator can be reprogrammed for good. So
yes,
you know, I think from my perspective, I think that automation has underlying code. Where does the underlying code come from? It comes from people, right? And so I think that automation is in certain ways, you know, good, you know, to help us with all these different types of things. So we get an automated email, you know, or a reminder 15 minutes before we're going to have a call or a phone call. You know, in customer relationship management, you know, automation does all these wonderful things. When we are, you know, going to a restaurant, we get a reminder of that. And so I think that there's a lot of benefits from automation. And here's the thing. At the end of the day, getting back to that, we're all human. Technology is going to take over certain types of jobs. And at the same time, it's going to create new ones. So I'm in the camp that, you know, you learned from your father's unemployment. I learned from my father's unemployment. Here we are in 2022. There are types of jobs that we don't know about that will exist in 5 years, that will exist in 10 years. So yes, automation will take over certain things that we currently know how to do as people. And at the same time, there will be new jobs created on things that we haven't even thought about. So that it becomes a larger question on our own capacity to learn, grow, develop with every, you know, 2 years, every 5 years, that we're maintaining our skill sets and we're developing, that we're not stagnant because the marketplace is changing. Automation is going to be here. That's not going away. It gets back to our own mindset, Connor, of our capacity to grow and develop and learn new things so that, you know, 10, 15, you know, even 15, 20 years ago, there was no such thing as a social media manager, right? Yes. Now that's not even a title anymore because it's just marketing. Like if you don't do digital, you know, the word marketing now, if you don't know digital, it's like, well, excuse me, you know, it's more life, right? So I think automation is a driver. I think it's an engine that's going to continue to fuel a lot of opportunity. And for the people that are open to that opportunity, they're going to get different types of roles and it's going to be called different things. And we're all, you know, and those people are going to benefit from it.
Yeah, I agree, Jason, with that really optimistic view of the future. I think some of the elements that you touched on there around adaptability, ability and willingness to learn and change are key, because I've got this really basic thought process that if you can't change, you're going to be in real difficulties, right? And the other point way I think, Jason, is no one's ever going to tap you on the shoulder and give you a whole lot of money for doing nothing, right? So if I can put this a different way, you or we and I, we got to have that ability to change, that willingness, that yearning for learning to do something different, because no one's ever going to hand it to you on a plate, right? Particularly the way the world's going these days. You got to put your hand up. You got to put your hand up, your head up, and be alert to these opportunities and ability and opportunities to learn. I think there's a lot to be said for that, because the schools and the universities, in my view, Jason, aren't really preparing the children and kids of today for even the jobs of today necessarily, let alone the potential jobs for tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I think that when I think of school, you know, you went to school, I went to school, and I, you know, I spent a year studying in France, which is a whole other way of school. It's much more of a lecture-based format than in America, where it's more interactive between teacher and student. But, you know, the one thing that I am impressed by in, you know, where I'm based in the District of Columbia, and there's a social-emotional component in school. They're talking about feelings. They're encouraging meditation. They're talking about their emotions and articulating emotions. And I think that when we get back to mindset, you know, Connor, I agree with you. Like, there are functional things that we can learn over time. But then there's an emotional capacity to be able to adapt to change. And I think that the more school can encourage and create opportunity for us to talk about feelings, to talk about our emotional states, that will allow us to better handle change. And, you know, for me, I would love to see core curriculum in high school and in college, you know, a social emotional component around how we feel about these things, because that's going to help us with a whole host of how we respond to change. And I agree with you that there is, you know, I'm a huge fan of internships in college. There, you know, it's called experiential learning. But, you know, I don't know about you, but growing up, I had a bunch of different side jobs. Like, I mowed lawns, and I did data entry for our local cleaners, and I babysat, and I did all these different kinds of odd jobs. And I think that we learn from, not only do we learn about the work itself, we start to learn about what we're good at and what we're not good at. So.
Yeah, I agree. And the other point that just tack on to that, Jason, is that you learn how to work with people, and hopefully the ability to understand people and how they think and what their rationale is. But I agree with you. I had loads of side jobs as a kid. Probably it would be illegal to do some of the jobs I did now, you know, when I think about I think about being age 12. I think one of my first jobs was actually, Jason, called a photocopying boy, and my job was basically to feed paper into one of those large Xerox photocopiers that would have existed in the late 80s, early 90s. I didn't go to work every day with a smile on my face during those summers, for sure, but I suppose it was character forming. But now that we're indulging in nostalgia and taking some of your pro tips there, Jason, I'd love to just look at the future briefly, if we may. And it's a question we like to finish up all of our shows with. And I apologies if it seems trite to you, Jason, but we'll ask it nonetheless. So, Jason, the question is, what is your prediction for the future of work?
I think my prediction for the future of work is that there will be so many different types of options and choices for people. And I think the future of work is going to be a version of what we're seeing now in this hybrid land. And so I think the future of work is really going to ask, what is the future of an office to look like? And I think that the future of the office will be some type of WeWork space, where we're going to be in some type of hoteling structure. And so where we work will continue to evolve. I think that's the future of work. I mean, you're talking to somebody, I went fully virtual 14 years ago, right? Yes. I haven't worked in an office since 2008. And I think that what people are yearning for, and it gets back to flexibility, I think the future of work is you are there depending on wherever you are, right?
Yes.
And so I'm curious what all these buildings are going to look like and what, you know, we call an office. And, you know, that should be interesting. So that's my thinking on the future of work.
I like it, Jason. And My thoughts on some of those buildings, I think of some of the skyscrapers in London or the skyscrapers in Atlanta or New York or on the other side of the river over in Jersey or New Jersey, is that I think in about 30 years, they're going to be the equivalent of the Colosseum in Rome. a really nice artifact, right? But that's my inner skeptic and cynic coming out. But I tell you, Jason, I've loved our conversation. I've really enjoyed your insights and your advices for our audience. And I really thank you very much for coming on the show. It's been a blast. And Jason, if I may, where is the best place for our audience to purchase your book and reach out to you if you care to share?
Well, I appreciate that. And Connor, it's been a real pleasure. I really enjoyed our conversation. So people can purchase Relationships to Infinity on Amazon.com or wherever you buy books online. People can check out my website, which is ReadySetLaunch.net. You can always drop me an email, jason@ReadySetLaunch.net. And always happy to have these conversations. It's been a real pleasure, Connor.
Yeah, I've really enjoyed it. And those two key phrases, the strength of weak ties and the power of dormant ties, I think are a lovely way to finish, Jason. So thanks so much for your time and wishing you a great day and weekend ahead. Thank you, sir.
Keep in touch, Connor.
You bet.